You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at One Crown Office Row.
I am Emma Louise Fenelon from One Crown Office Row Chambers, and here with me to talk about recent developments with regard to women's rights in healthcare and informed consent in the context of childbirth is Suzanne White from Lide. Suzanne is head of clinical negligence at Lide, and she has a particular interest in birth injury claims, injuries to mothers during childbirth, orthopaedics, misdiagnosed cancers, GP errors, and cases involving radiological errors, but advises on a full range of clinical negligence cases. She is on the executive of the Association for Personal Injury Lawyers and is a member of the Civil Justice Council Working Group for Fixed Costs. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you very much, Emma.
A significant amount of your practice involves cases concerning women's rights in health. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, it's a real privilege to be asked to do this podcast on such an important topic. I've been working at Lide for 20 years in clinical negligence, and women's healthcare and their rights has been a huge part of my practice. Obviously, working in obstetric cases where a mother has gone through a traumatic birth and their child may be injured, but also about the injuries they may themselves have suffered as a result of any traumatic birth. Those injuries can include psychological injury, and they're estimated to be in the region of about 20,000 women with PTSD after a traumatic birth. Then there's maternal injury such as fourth degree tears, where often mothers are not warned of the possible problems they will endure as a result of severe tear, or are even aware that there are symptoms are not normal. They are often dismissed by the medical profession, not treated early enough, and often women are too embarrassed by their injury to get help or talk about the terrible impact it may have on their life. I've also acted on wrongful birth cases where the mother is carrying a child that is very disabled but is not made aware of any abnormality. These are obviously hugely sensitive and difficult cases. I've also represented families where there's been the death of a baby during labour or the mother. And also I have an interest in breast cancer, which is right at the forefront of women's rights in healthcare at the moment, delaying cancer cases. With the evolution of radiotherapy care in the form of target or intraoperative radiotherapy care, it'll be very interesting to see how consent plays out in women's treatment and choice in the future. I've also worked on a number of the mesh cases, which are deeply traumatic for those who are left with mesh. Mesh is causing great pain and suffering and misery. So I've had a real wide variety of cases to work on. I'm very lucky and fortunate to have such an interesting caseload.
Listeners will be familiar with the 2015 Supreme Court decision in Montgomery. But before that case, as we all know, the standard that governed was a case called Bolam. Can you tell us about how this operated in practice?
For my view, is Bolam is archaic. It is paternalistic and patronising for patients in the form of consent, and allows the doctor to make all decisions, decide what he thinks is right for the patient to know, rather than taking into account what they might want to know. The patient has a right to determine what they shall or shall not want done to their body, and they have a right to decline treatment too, such as a Jehovah's Witness. So as far as Bolam and consent cases before Montgomery were run, they were very difficult to proceed with, because the Bolam was very much about what doctor knows best. I think there was a reluctance to take these cases on, certainly from my perspective. They were very difficult because you were saying that the doctor was wrong in what they were telling a patient in terms of consent.
And so as you mentioned, Montgomery then introduced the idea of a patient-centred approach. And as someone dealing with women's healthcare day to day, what changes did you observe in medical practice following Montgomery?
Well, I think it has been a real vehicle for change. Before the decision, Montgomery has provided us with a real opportunity to think about women's rights in health. Montgomery is a perfect case to allow the opportunity for a Bolam decision to be changed. And it presents the perfect storm in which we had the opportunity to attack Bolam. As we all know, the test is, would in the circumstances that that particular case, a reasonable person in the patient's position, be likely to attach significant to the risks, or the doctor is or should be aware that the patient would likely attach significance to it. The doctor has to take an intelligent and rational approach and look at what that reasonable person would want. So it has had a huge impact, in my view, on my practice and clinical negligence lawyers' practice throughout the country. And it's had a particular impact for women's health, particularly obstetric care. Midwives, obstetricians, surgeons are completely alive to Montgomery now. Some are sadly concerned about it and have concerns that they are scaring patients, which I really don't think is true. I think patients are entitled to make choices about what's going to happen to their body and their care. My view is that I think it's an opportunity to be embraced by the medical profession to clarify consent and actually protect themselves. I think it's a really good driver for good consent and patient choice. And as far as I'm concerned with my practice now, it is discussed in every single case I do, and all my experts do consider it. So it has made a really huge difference.
Claimants have relied upon the Montgomery decision with success in a number of cases recently, including Webster and Burton Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, a 2017 Court of Appeal decision, Tiefold and Johnston, a High Court decision from 2017, and Hassell and Hillingdon Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, a 2018 decision. Can you tell us a little bit about these?
Well, there's some new and very interesting case law that's evolving the law in consent, particularly recent cases such as Webster, where Sebastian Webster suffered a catastrophic brain damage as a result of hypoxic ischemia, which occurred between 72 and 48 hours before his delivery. His mother should have been given the choice to be induced and been fully aware of the abnormalities, or whether the baby should have been born at 41 weeks. The defendant argued that even if the scans had been done at the time that they should have been done, they would have been reassuring and not given rise to the need for heightened vigilance or advice about dangers. This case failed at first instance as the judge applied the Bolam tests and the case went to the Court of Appeal. The judge applied the Montgomery and stated, "I think had the mother been advised that she should proceed to induction or that there were increased risks in waiting until the 6th or 7th of January, she would have wanted to be delivered. I think she was fed up of the pregnancy and with the lack of well-being, and it was a due date that she had in mind. She would not have wanted it to be put off since the prospect of induction was looming in any event. The mother had a degree in nursing and her evidence was any suggestion of a risk, I would have wanted him to be delivered." So by the 27th of December, she would have been told that her pregnancy was subject to unusual features, if not complications, and she would have needed to know the implications to her baby so as to make a decision about the birth if she'd been given the information that she should have been given. It is clear that she would have chosen to proceed to an induction on the 27th of December, her due date rather than the delayed delivery, and the baby would have been born normal. The mother had made an excellent witness in this case, and I think that's a very key issue in a lot of these cases, as we will discuss. The claimant succeeded in the Court of Appeal, but the interesting thing about this and its effect on Montgomery is that the decision initially was judged on a Bolam test, and eventually the Court of Appeal said, no, actually, we're going to look at Montgomery and take account of that instead. It was a really interesting development in the case law because Montgomery was effectively reiterated in my view. Further developments have been in the case of Hassell, one of my colleagues' cases. The case revolved around treatment of Mrs. Hassell, and she received at the Defendant's Hospital between June and October 2011. Mrs. Hassell was suffering with ongoing neck and upper arm pain and underwent C5, C6 decompression and disc replacement surgery on the 3rd of October 2011 under the care of a Mr. Sean Ridgway. He was a spinal surgeon. During the course of the procedure, Mrs. Hassell very unfortunately suffered a spinal cord injury, was rendered paralysed and permanently disabled, and the value of the claim was agreed before the trial, but breach of duty and causation remained in dispute. Mrs. Hassell argued that she was not warned of the risk of paralysis, nor was she offered conservative treatment. It was her case that had she been warned, she would have considered it too high and not gone ahead with the surgery. She also argued that Mr. Ridgway failed to carry out the procedure with reasonable care and skill. The trust stated that Mrs. Hassell was properly warned of the risks and the surgery was carried out with reasonable care and skill. The decision is really an interesting one because it largely turned on what Mr. Ridgway said, or rather didn't say, in his witness statement and during the course of his evidence at trial. In addition to this, in corresponding, he had written prior to the surgery, he had not properly set out the risks of paralysis. So Mr. Justice Dingmans found that Mr. Ridgway had erroneously concluded that Mrs. Hassell had already undergone physiotherapy for her neck pain, and because of this mistake, did not properly discuss conservative treatment with her. Had he discussed conservative treatment options with her, Mrs. Hassell would have been able to correct his incorrect assumption that there was no criticism of the actual care he gave. The operation he did was perfectly fine. Justice Stigman said, I find that Mr. Ridgway used reasonable care and skill in carrying out the operation and that I am unable to identify the cause of Mrs. Hassell's spinal cord injury. I found that Mrs. Hassell did not give informed consent to the operation and that if she had been given the information about material risk and conservative treatment, that Mrs. Hassell would not have agreed to the operation on the 3rd of October 2011. The judge also said, whatever Mr. Ridgway's strengths as a surgeon when carrying out the operation, Mr. Ridgway was not a good communicator about the risks of the operation. And very interestingly, effectively, the surgeon gave appropriate care, but failed to consent properly. And there's a further case of Tefault, which is interesting, as the surgeon overly optimistically gave advice about the procedure. And again, Montgomery was applied. And effectively, the degree of risk was discussed and quoted in the judgment being the assessment of whether a risk is material cannot be reduced to percentages. The significance of a given risk is likely to reflect a variety of factors besides its magnitude. For example, the nature of risks, the effect which its occurrence would have had upon the life of a patient, the importance to the patient of the benefits sought to be achieved by treatment, the alternatives available and the risks involved in those alternatives. The assessment is therefore fact-sensitive and sensitive also to the characteristic of the patient. These judgments show that all these cases, I think the witness evidence by the claimant was key because they were very articulate and clear about what the consent procedure would have been and what they would have done in view of the consent they should have obtained. In terms of impact on cases now, clinical negligence cases take a very long time to go through litigation, sometimes 3 or 4 years. So they're very new cases. We just have to see how they get embedded in the law.
Informed consent was in the news lately in relation to maternal request cesareans. The National Institute of Health and Care Excellence, or NICE guidelines, indicate that women should be allowed to undergo elective cesareans. But Birthrights, a human rights in childbirth charity, using data gathered from a Freedom of Information request, reported in August this year that just over a quarter of NHS trusts fully comply with these guidelines. Has this been your experience?
It's a very interesting article indeed, and Birthrights is a phenomenal charity which is doing great work. Since its revision in 2011, the NICE best practice guidance has rightly recognised that women should be involved in the decision-making in childbirth and also protecting the right of individual doctors to decline to support any individual who requests a C-section on non-medical grounds. But 1 in 6 NHS trusts don't offer cesareans on request. The publication of this research showed that nearly 3/4 of the NHS trusts do not have written guidelines, and it can be really very difficult to get accurate information about local policies and guidelines for women. So therefore, there are real issues about women not being offered a C-section when they want them. Some trusts have even implemented policies that effectively ban maternal requests on C-sections. My view is that it's got to be contrary to NICE guidelines and potentially a breach of human rights obligations. Women must be informed and have autonomy of choice, and this, of course, is set out in the Human Rights Act, Article 8. It is a fundamental human right to determine what should be done with your own body. Mothers are usually well, healthy women who are going through a natural physical process. They are usually not ill. They have a right to autonomy with their body. As they carry their child, they should be fully informed about their pregnancies and mode for delivery and potential risks for them and their baby. I don't think it can be right that a doctor can decide what she thinks she should tell you about the risks of your pregnancy and the risks of delivery. And as Lady Hell said in Montgomery, as NICE puts it, pregnant women should be offered evidence-based information and support to enable them to make informed decisions about their care and treatment. Gone are the days when it was thought that on becoming pregnant, a woman lost not only her capacity, but also her right to act as a generally autonomous human being.
Those doctors adhering to the letter and spirit of Montgomery will necessarily require more time to consent patients for procedures, which will also entail a cost. What's your view on this?
I believe it's part of a doctor's professional skill to be able to communicate with their patient. He or she should be able to judge their patient and explain to them in a manner they understand what are the risks, but also listen to what they want from their birth experience. We cannot patronise patients with the argument it is best they do not worry their heads about the risks. Of course, if the patient says they do not want to know the ins and outs of risks, then it is also appropriate as set out in the judgment. But I do believe that women must be fully informed and have autonomy. If they have a healthy and safe pregnancy and delivery, which is very likely, then knowing the risks is not problematic. But things can go wrong. Babies can die. Women do get terrible birth injuries. Babies suffer brain damage. And if they do have a clear understanding of the risks, it can help the mother then come to terms with this and understand what had happened. From my experience, being consented properly would improve this situation. There would be some forewarning. When I speak to women who have suffered trauma, they remember it like it was yesterday, and it impacts terribly on their future birth. And this has an impact on those women, their family, and how they function in the future. It still really shocks me that so many women are not aware of perineal tears after giving birth and the terrible impact that has on life. And women just carry on living without discussing their symptoms and the real impact it has on their lives. Yes, of course, it will mean longer time to consent patients. But if it's done properly, we have enormous benefits in the future for patients, for their mental health. And I think in the long run, that will impact on the cost to the NHS.
Suzanne, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and hopefully we'll have you again here soon.
LawPod UK is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.